Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So, today the U.S. Supreme Court, and we've been waiting for this, heard oral arguments in the DACA case. You know, what are we going to do with all of these kids whose parents brought them here? They've gone through the school system. This is the only country they've known. And now you've got the Trump administration who's saying, you know, we're going to send them back. We're kicking them out. And you're talking something more like 700,000 people. Again, for all the big bus people, you're going to need a really big bus. And it's going to be really chaotic, and it's going to be really, really, it's going to be damn near impossible. But here to share some thoughts on the day's hearings and share some ideas of maybe how this comes out. Maybe we'll be surprised. I'm not so sure, which is why I've asked Hassan Ahmad to come talk with us. He's an immigration lawyer from Virginia. Hassan, thanks for taking time for us.
Hey, thanks so much for having me again, Rick.
So I got to tell you, everything I'm reading, not good.
You know, I wish I felt more encouraged as well. I attended the oral arguments this morning. I'm a member of the Supreme Court bar, and got in. Showed up to queue up outside the Supreme Court about 6 o'clock this morning, and argument started right at 10 o'clock. And you know, there are two issues that were really at the forefront of oral arguments. One was the issue of reviewability. When does a court actually have the power to second guess an agency if it decides to reverse itself and say we don't want to offer these deportation protections to an entire class, you know, 700,000, 800,000 dreamers? And the second question that came up was the issue of what they called engendered reliance, which is a fancy term for basically saying, all right, these people have had work authorization, they've worked, they've been able to go to school, they've been able to sort of come onto the grid. Their families, their employers, their communities have now, you know, relied on them. Many of them are they're employed, and this is going to obviously hurt universities and employers and businesses and communities if these people are suddenly robbed of their ability to lawfully work in the United States. And so there's the policy itself engendered reliance amongst these communities, not just the dreamers themselves, but we're talking about the roots that they've set into the country. And this is even, you know, after the fact that most of them have obviously been here since a young age. That's what you had to do in order to get DACA.
Right.
So reviewability and engendered reliance. And all of the justices who spoke this morning were very concerned about their ability to actually review the case, with the liberal justices kind of saying, well, of course, are you saying that we don't have the power to review this agency decision? And when the only thing they've done is, in spite of all of the amicus briefs and all of the evidence that's in the record about how important dreamers are to our country as a whole, were just sidestepped by the administration, and they just basically came out with something that says, well, we think DACA is illegal anyway, so we're not going to bother, we're going to reverse it, and even if we did think it was legal, we still don't think it makes for good policy, because we are a law enforcement agency, and we need to be able to enforce the law as we see fit. And yeah, we looked at all the evidence that was submitted, and we just don't think it's good enough. I mean, no, they have to show their math. They have to explain why they're taking on this, why they're reversing policy. And the liberal justices were saying they didn't do nearly enough, and the conservative justices were saying, well, they said they looked at it. Who are we to second guess it?
Right, because one of the things, one of the things that I was, you know, I was waiting to hear is, because one of the arguments I heard is the Trump administration failed to give adequate reasoning to end the program, other than I just want to, and
right.
The lower courts said, called the initial explanation arbitrary and capricious. If I've got this right,
correct, yeah,
and that's the reason that they were willing to toss it out.
Right, and I think one of the important moments in the arguments this morning was that all sides agree that the administration has the right to revoke DACA. It's a question of how it's done.
Right?
Right? Is it done legally? Did they do so? Given proper you know, notice and comment, and did they follow all the rules with the Administrative Procedures Act, and did they show their math when they actually showed, did they weigh the equities, did they think this thing through, or did they just, you know, are they ruling by executive fiat, essentially rule by tweet? You know, because really that's all there was to it.
Right. And now, but speaking of that, I mean, since you brought up rule by tweet, you know, Trump tweeted out many of the DACA, many of the people in DACA, no longer very young, are far from angels. Some are very tough, hardened criminals. President Obama said he had no legal right to sign order, but would anyway. If Supreme Court remedies with overturn, a deal will be made with Dems for them to stay. There's a lot there. First part of it is for me, let's start with the Obama thing. Did Obama say he didn't have the right to sign it, but signed it anyway? Did I miss that?
Yeah, you know, what I think what he was talking about, he doesn't have the right, and this has never been, you know, challenged, that he doesn't have the right to confer legal status onto anybody without an act of Congress. Clearly, that would be a violation of separation of powers. What he does have the right to do is to set a policy for prioritization, and that's all DACA ever was.
Right.
Now, there are other, you know, using the vehicle of deferred action, and deferred action has been a part of the law for a very long time. You know, it first actually came to light in a FOIA lawsuit that was filed by John Lennon back in the day, when the INS was trying to deport him for marijuana related offenses. And in that multi-million-dollar, you know, lawsuits that were filed, this policy of deferred action, and you know, we used to use it all the time when attorneys, when DACA came out, we're like, okay, cool, this is just deferred action, except it's now all we have to do is show that our client meets these requirements coming into the U.S. at the age under the age of 16, et cetera, et cetera. And they can now get the benefit of deferred action. The law has existed. The policy has existed for a long time. And that's all Obama did. That's all DACA was. And that's why no court has ever found DACA to be unconstitutional or an outsized exercise of executive power.
Right.
And that's a fact that I think is lost on a lot of people who are you know, against DACA. They think that it was ruled unconstitutional, and it never has been.
Right, but in that vein, you know, and this is my problem with executive action. With one president being able to do it, another can undo it just as easily, no?
Yeah, true. And in this case, it should be a pretty simple act. But this administration has shown time and time again that they can't follow the law.
Right.
So even when you revoke it, there's a procedure that has to be followed. And when you have a large class of people who have, you know, not only them, but other people have relied on the work authorization and protection that they've been afforded, then it becomes all the more important for that agency to follow the law and show their math. I mean, this is essentially about transparency, right? We don't want our government to just willy-nilly, whenever they, you know, wind blows in a certain direction, for them to start reversing policies that uproots the lives of hundreds of thousands of people. So all we're saying is you got to show your math, and you didn't. And that's the reason why the only thing illegal about DACA was the way it was revoked.
So technically, if let's say this goes, you know, even if it goes the way that we hope it goes, that they uphold DACA, Trump could turn around, you know, the day after and say, well, fine, okay, we're gonna follow the rules, and they're still gone anyway, right? I mean, is that how I'm understanding this?
We've known, yeah, I agree, and DACA is on the chopping block, but I think that this administration really wants to expand their power and be able to revoke. Policies like DACA without having to give an explanation for it. I mean, we saw this with the travel ban, the Muslim ban, where the first version and the second version were all swiftly, you know, enjoined by the courts. Look, at the end of the day, if they wanted to block people, there was a million other ways to block them as opposed to doing it based on Muslim, you know, population in that country, right? There were a lot of ways to do it. And effectively get the same result of banning people from these countries without actually mentioning that they have to be from that country, right?
Right.
But they didn't want that. They wanted to be able to do it on the basis of nationality.
And they wanted to pump out their chests and make the political argument.
Exactly. Exactly. Politics. So, red meat for the base.
No, no, that's not shocking, and it's not news. It is what it is. The part that gets me is that, you know, you've, again, going back to Trump's tweets, there's always this frame that, you know, all of these people are all criminals, and not just here illegally, they're hardened criminals. These are very tough, hardened criminals. And
yet, if you just read the regs on DACA, if you have more than one serious misdemeanor, right, or any felony conviction, you are ineligible for DACA. So the fact that you even have DACA means, by law, as a matter of law, you cannot be a hardened criminal. You can't. So, I mean, that's the first problem with the tweet. The second problem is, if they were hardened criminals, why on earth would he want to make a deal to keep them in the country anyway? So it contradicts itself on its face.
No, excellent point. But here's the thing, and I was going to get to that part, the last part of his tweet, you know, regardless of what happens, you know, if the Supreme Court remedies with overturn, which means he gets to throw everybody out, he believes a deal is going to be made with Democrats, which I'm sure he'll try and extort something out of them. If we look at what's been going on lately. My question is, why can't we just do that without going through all of this court proceedings and all of this? Because, look, I think the American people overwhelmingly support allowing these folks to stay.
You're right. They absolutely do. I mean, public opinion, judging from the size of the crowds in front of the Supreme Court this morning, or just the sheer number of amicus briefs that were filed in the Supreme Court case, and poll after poll after poll, show that you're right. The American people are with the idea of letting dreamers stay. But that's not how he wants to do it.
Yeah, because after all, and this is where the logical part of my mind works, you know, most of these kids went through our school systems.
Right.
We spent the money to educate them. A lot of them have started businesses. They own homes. They're part of the community.
Right.
They've got jobs. It just seems like ripping that all apart is kind of stupid. And then the cruelty angle of sending these people back to places where they have no idea where they're going or even a lot speak the language. I mean, you know, I've told the story of, you know, friends that I knew as a kid growing up whose parents were immigrants from Ukraine or from Germany or places where grandma spoke no English whatsoever. The parents spoke a little broken English and the old language, and the kids didn't know anything other than the swear words.
Right, exactly. Yeah. No, I'm a child of immigrants myself, and I've seen that myself. My parents taught me our heritage language, and so I speak it fluently. But my kids, yeah, it's tough. I mean, the language is, if my kids had to go back to some other country that they never, it'd be earth-shattering for them. I can't even imagine what it would be like.
But ultimately, I look at this, Hassan, and I'm going, you know, at some point legislatively, we've got to figure this out because, you know, right now I just saw this story before we spoke that something like almost 70,000 migrant children are in government custody this year. It's nearly 70,000 kids, up 42% from last year, locked in cages. And you go, something has to be done. And look, whatever it is, we got to figure it out. But you can't keep holding people. Evidently, we're holding more people for longer periods of time. And we're not talking people. We're talking children. These are just kids.
Yeah. Right.
There's something wrong with our policy.
Clearly, it's this idea. I mean, we talked about, you were alluding to before, correctly, I think, about, you know, this bad marriage of immigration to criminality, right? This is the result of that. When you consider every immigrant a potential criminal, or you consider every immigrant a criminal if they don't come to the United States in a certain way or don't come from a certain country or whatever, then, yeah, it becomes very easy to lock people up, right? It becomes very easy to lock up children because it's easy to fall back on, hey, they're lawbreakers. They're lawbreakers. And it starts off with that bad marriage, and the trauma of that bad marriage is something that we're seeing unfold at the border, inside the United States, at the airports, and sadly, in today's Supreme Court argument.
Yeah. Well, let me ask you this, because, you know, I believe there has to be a legislative fix. Congress has to be able to do their job at some point, but I don't see the Republicans being able to make any type of of deal, much like Reagan did back in the 80s. I just don't see them being able to do that with their base being as rabidly opposed to or seem to be. Maybe you know something I don't, but seem to be rabidly opposed to allowing these folks to stay.
They're either rabidly opposed to it or they're not strong enough to stand up to those who are. Either way, you're at a deadlock. And that's the real genius. I mean, I've been, you've known from prior episodes that I've done on your show about my lawsuit against the University of Michigan to unseal the papers of John Tanton, who was a white nationalist and founded the organizations that have created all of these policies, right? The ones that the brains behind the operation. And they have successfully framed it to the point, and I was listening to the arguments today, and this thought just kept going into my head, that even the pro-DACA folks are stuck giving examples like, well, let's say a prosecutor doesn't want to prosecute cases involving less than 5 kilos of cocaine. You know, you're still, like, just bringing up the whole thing because immigration criminal has been hammered into people's minds, into our public consciousness for so long. We don't know any other way to talk about it.
Yeah.
Right? Imagine how different it would be if we actually started talking about it in terms of empowerment, in terms of family unity, in terms of prosperity. Right? Something positive, something that you don't, you know, that doesn't always look at an immigrant as somebody who is going to come and take something and leave be a net negative to this country. Because they're not, you know? But at the same time, you can't clip the wings off of a bird and expect it and then blame it for not flying. But that's exactly what's happening.
You know, as somebody who's spent a lot of time in hotels and you know, spent a lot of time going through various factories and stuff in my regular job, most of the people that I've run into who are immigrants are really hardworking people who are at the bottom rung of the ladder, who are exploited, abused, and cheated at every turn. So it's my view that we have to figure something out to get these folks out of the shadow so that we don't continue to allow them to be exploited, abused, and cheated. Because ultimately, you know, back to the old labor frame of an injury to one being an injury to all, if we allow that to happen to them, guess what happens to us in the long run? So, you know, maybe it's going back to radical self-interest. I'm not sure. But I think at some point we've got to grapple with this and get our hands around it.
You know, immigration is emphatically a labor issue. And we are talking about worker protections and being able to make sure that people aren't the victims of payroll fraud or unscrupulous, you know, contractors that leave them stiff with the bill and threaten to call ICE on them when they if they dare ask for a paycheck, and just you know, treating people in a humane manner that allows them to grow and prosper and actually contribute, because all these policies that do the exact opposite of that, we're only shooting ourselves in the foot because, like it or not, an immigrant is an aspiring American.
Right.
We're shooting ourselves in the foot.
No, but here's the other frame of that is by having all these immigrants come in, they're taking jobs Americans would take and thus lowering the wage. But ultimately what's happening is by having folks here, because employers are still drawing them here, you're lowering the wage by having them in the shadows more than you would if they were out in the regular workforce like everyone else.
Right. No, if the policies would allow people to go, come and, you know, cross the borders in both directions, be able to come and go, bring families when they need to, return home when they want to, our laws don't allow for that right now. They don't allow for it.
Right.
And, you know, going back to the idea about, you know, giving a humane, you know, worker system, I mean, this is what we're – America has to be a place where you come to prove yourself. You don't have to prove yourself just to come here. That's never been the idea of being American, and they're trying to change it into something, well, if you speak English and you have these skills and you come from these countries, then you can come. Otherwise, we don't need you. We don't want you.
Right. So last question I've got for you, you know, because, you know, ultimately it comes down to, the question of, you know, how many people do you let in? Do you swing the door wide open? Do you slam it completely shut? I mean, ultimately that's what you're going to be dealing with. And is there a formula? Is there something that you see as workable? How do you see a solution, or if there is even one available? I'm curious.
Well, I think the policies have to. I think we need to start by understanding that the economy in our country is not. It's not a zero sum game. We are not a pie to be divided. We are a kitchen that can bake as many pies as we have ingredients for. So you start from that point, and then after that, we can let the market decide and allow people to move back and forth, go where they're needed to, especially in places where there's a labor shortage, and use the immigration system as the tool that it was intended to build prosperity. So there's all kinds of ways that, you know, for example, just a small example, the H-1B cap for skilled or professional workers that require at least a bachelor's degree. They put this hard cap on it of $65,000 a year, right? Every year, four times as many petitions get filed, so the demand is is about four times as much as supply. And really all they're doing is putting a quota on the intelligence and the work that clearly, you know, is there because the demand is actually there. So if we allow that to be a market-based cap, my ideas have come up in the past about this, all these people that are supposedly pro-business and small government and everything and wanting the market to take care of everything, why is it that they want super regulation only when it comes to immigration? The rest of the time they're all talking about the market ruling everything, right? Let the market rule it then, fine. You know, but just have policies that allow the market to rule. And I think that might be a good starting place.
Yeah, it's somewhere. I mean, it's better than where we are today. So it'll be interesting to see where this ruling comes down and ultimately where we end up after. But sadly, I don't see us letting kids out of cages anytime soon, which is I don't even know the word strong enough. I don't even know the strong enough words to.
It's a blight on our country. It really is. We're going to look back on this as a really, really shameful time in our history.
I don't have to look back on it. It's already a shameful time.
It's already a shame. You're
Hassan, right. I appreciate you taking time for us. Thanks for sharing your experience.
Always a pleasure, Rick. Thanks so much.
Good stuff, Hassan Ahmad. He is an immigration lawyer there in Virginia. You can follow him on Twitter. We'll get stuff out. He's my go-to guy for immigration. Let's take a quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.